This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. When President Obama announced the U.S. was renewing diplomatic relations with Cuba last year, companies here began working on plans to introduce their products to the Cuban market. Last month, a group from the Xavier University Williams College of Business spent 9 days in Cuba learning about its history, culture, and economics. They also saw firsthand some of the real challenges and opportunities companies that want to do business in the changing Cuban economy are going to face. Joining us to talk about their trip and what they learned are Xavier University Williams College of Business Chair and Professor of Marketing, Dr. Thomas Hayes, Xavier MBA student and tax manager with Barnes Dennig, Heather Hotlos, and a junior studying international business at Xavier, Scott Quintanmont. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tom, Scott, Heather, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tom, what are the implications of this, of being able to reestablish trade with Cuba after all these years? How much potential do you see in this?
Well, I think one of the things that we teach at the university, especially from a marketing perspective, is that you can invest in change, fight in change, or create change, and there's only one way to lose, and that's fight it. And as you look at the progress, especially since Raul Castro took over from his brother, you know, in 2006 and then officially in 2008, they've been undergoing a lot of changes and implementing a lot of reform in the country. And so as you look at this, there's a the country itself is sort of frozen in 1959. You know, and so the infrastructure, business, et cetera, and they're rapidly changing over the last couple of years. And so it's one of those things that when it opens, because it will eventually, you know, probably sooner than later, I think it's a rare opportunity for people to sort of get in early. And part of that is that you really have to understand the country, its culture, and especially the way the system works, the Cuban sort of legal and government system. And that means getting used to it now.
How big of a market could this turn out to be?
Well, I think it depends, and I'll let Heather and Scott comment on some of this. I think it really depends on the area. You know, so one of the first ones that I'm sure Heather will jump into is, for example, is telecommunications.
Telecommunications, yes, and accounting. So a couple of the things that they've been doing, the Cuban government has been forward-thinking in getting ready for relations to open with the U.S. and other countries coming along with them. They've moved their port in the process to Mariel. So their main port of Havana, they're moving all the shipping and cargo to Mariel to make room for increased tourism, so to be using the port of Havana. In doing that, we actually have already seen a cruise ship come through there while we were there, which was very, very nice to see. In looking at opening up, they also are allowing a different levels of entrepreneurship within the country. And one place that we visited was called Censis. So it was the first accounting cooperative in Cuba. That accounting cooperative, there are now five, and they're actually interested in maybe exporting accounting services.
And I'd say, going off what Heather said, tourism, I think, is probably one of the biggest, most obvious, because it is, you know, a large Caribbean island that's, you know, people from the United States currently don't have access to. And it's an extremely well-educated population. They're already receiving tourists from different places in the world. So I think it's something that when it does open up, that'll be a huge sector, especially for the United States, given the fact that it's only, you know, a 45-minute plane ride from Cuba. And there's a large English-speaking population and all that. So I think that's another huge opportunity that's just kind of waiting to be explored.
Yeah. Any company that can add to the infrastructure, the business infrastructure, would be more than welcome. Cuba was actually one of the last countries in the world that had internet. They actually had the cable wasn't even laid to Cuba until 2010, and it didn't work till 2013.
Wow.
So the first time we went to the first time Xavier brought students, it was in 2014, March 2014, and then the internet was, you could get it very limited, very expensive, and maybe at two or three computer stations at a hotel. Now, a year and a half later, there are parks everywhere that have Wi-Fi zones. And so just last week was announced an agreement where they're actually going to be expanding internet cafes and internet for businesses. And so when you look at the place, it's again, literally frozen in so many ways. And anything that can add to the business infrastructure, just in things of construction, for example. A famous Cuban saying down there is that Cubans don't throw away anything. They just find a way to reuse it. And so one of the things that's sort of holding them back is just that they don't have the equipment to be able to modernize anything at this point in time.
To follow up with Tom's comment about they just reuse things, I had a great example. We were on the ferry going across the Bay of Havana, and there was a woman sitting next to me, and she had curlers in her hair, but they were made out of PVC pipe. And she had earrings in her ears, but when I looked a little closer, they were actually thumbtacks. So reusing everything.
Sounds like we could learn a lot about recycling from the Cuban people.
We could. There are many things we could learn from them.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And so, Tom, this was your second trip. You went
right
on the one in 2014. You're talking about the one change that you noticed in internet access. Were there other changes that you noticed between that 2014 trip and this one?
Sure. Raul implemented, when he officially took over as president of the cabinet in 2008. He actually started in 2006 when Fidel got ill. And so he spent 2 years sort of reforming the government. In 2008, he really started to implement a lot of changes and encourage small business and entrepreneurship. And during that period of time, because they realized, as Raul would say, the system that they were using just wasn't working. You know, so he needed to shift it. And so they started to encourage a lot more private business and entrepreneurship, to the point that they actually teach entrepreneurship at the University of Havana as part of the process. And so between the year and a half, there were exponentially more businesses in existence than the first time. And Senius, which Heather was talking about, was a perfect example of it. And I'll let her talk about how their rapid growth in 1 year.
So in the period of a year, they went from three founding partners, if you will, to about 143. So increasing, you know, a few people every couple days. So, and now there are five accounting cooperatives in Cuba at this point.
Yeah.
So one other thing that Tom had mentioned about the internet. So when we went down there, we were expecting to have absolutely no access. So we were able to get internet through our phones, email. I was actually able to get phone calls as well, although they were extremely expensive, about $3 a minute.
But that came as a big surprise. And what time you said it was 2013 before they actually had the system up and running?
Right. The cable was laid for Venezuela in 2010. But they, for a lot of government purposes or whatever, they didn't actually have it working efficiently until 3 years later.
Do you get the impression, Tom, that Cuba is going to embrace capitalism totally, or is this going to be a gradual shift, a hybrid kind of thing?
I think it's more of a hybrid, and I think your best model to look at would be the Vietnamese model, you know, and a lot of China, a lot of capitalistic concepts, a lot of entrepreneurship, but still very much more of a centralized government.
Scott, tell me about your impressions of the people you met while you were in Cuba.
I think one thing that we all kind of found maybe a little bit surprising was how happy they were to have us. I would say, just there was never really an instance that anyone was upset that we were there from the United States, which I think some people may have been expecting, you know, given the relationship. And, you know, the government is very vocal in their, lack of support, I guess, for the United States in a nice way. But, you know, everywhere we went, everyone was very excited to have us there. And I think that just kind of shows that the people are very excited for the possibility of there, you know, being increased relations and, you know, possibly eventually opening up trade. Because, everywhere we went, people were always toasting to, you know, bettering the relationship between the two countries. And just the fact that we were there, there's a lot of hope.
Friendly, welcoming.
Yeah.
Looking forward to when the embargo is actually going to be truly ended. Actually, in the airport, I met a gentleman that he was insistent that it already had ended. I had to give up that fight because he wasn't going to change his mind.
And Scott, I guess you're a Spanish major too, right? So that probably helped you a lot on this trip.
Yes, it did. There were times where I kind of served as the translator, which led to some interesting moments. And that was, I think, an advantage as well, being able to speak to more people, being a little bit more open, and being able to gather an opinion sort of the people. That was a really interesting take, and it was something that was, really valuable for this trip.
Scott brokered several transactions.
And did you feel pretty comfortable in this whole arrangement? I mean, you didn't feel like you had anybody watching over you while you were talking to these folks?
Not at all. Very never. Safe. Even another girl that was on the trip and I were out late at night, probably 11:30, 12 at night, walking around. And actually, someone walked up to us and asked us if we felt safe, which was a little alarming, actually, to be approached that way. But it did truly feel safe.
And I'd say kind of another, I guess, surprising part of the trip was, going into this perceived socialist state, you expect there to be a large government presence, large police presence. But even compared to other travels to other Latin American countries, other countries, there really wasn't a large police presence anywhere, enough to feel safe, but not like we were ever, we felt like we were ever being watched, anything like that, which was really surprising, I think.
When we were at the Museum of the Revolution at about 11:30 at night, there were several guards.
Yeah. But, we started to go to China way before when China first opened up, and it was very common to have people following you. I mean, it was very common to have police trailing you, et cetera, and there's nothing like that in Cuba.
There were a few times that I noticed people did temper their comments, though, and wouldn't say anything specific about the government, no matter even they were in the lobby of the hotel, because they tended to think someone could be listening.
How much access did you have? Were you pretty much free to go where you wanted to go and see what you wanted to see?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yep. It's wide open.
What was the most interesting thing to you, Scott, when you were in Cuba?
I guess how entrepreneurial some of the people were. Not much of that at all. Once again, it's been, the socialist state for almost 60 years now. But when we were there, one of the examples I've been telling is in order to get on the internet, we had to buy these internet cards. And it was, I believe they cost $2 from the telephone company to purchase. But what would happen was people would go early in the morning, buy them all for $2, and then go to the park, the Wi-Fi zones, and then sell them for $3 a card. So they're just, making a dollar a card. But it was really fascinating. Just kind of everywhere we went, people would kind of be finding a way to make an additional dollar on top of, what they normally made in a month, which I thought was really interesting and kind of showed, I think, the ability, if things were open up, how ready I think they would be. It wouldn't be as shocking as some people may.
So you think there's a strong entrepreneurial spirit in the country?
Yes, very much, yeah.
And if you put that in perspective, when Scott mentioned what they make in a month, it's about 25 to 30 U.S. dollars. So with the accounting cooperative, they're incentivizing performance. So some of the people there are making maybe about six times what the typical Cuban wages are.
Tom, can you tell us where things stand now as far as the interactions with Cuba and what's allowed and not allowed as far as travel? I think a lot of people are still confused about the status since President Obama started normalizing relations with Cuba.
Well, since one of the things President Obama did with normalizing relationships was eased up on what's necessary for visas to be able to travel there. I mean, so there are still 13 different categories of which education, art, even building is you can go into, and you don't need special visas anymore as long as you're going through that direction, and it's opened it up quite a bit. Travel to Cuba since the time President Obama opened it has increased 36% from America, United States, and that doesn't count the Americans that went through other countries, and because there's been a long tradition of people visiting Cuba but coming from Mexico or Canada because they would never stamp your card. They would let you in because they would encourage it, but they would never stamp your passports. And so there has been even a much larger increase in it. The normalization process, I think, has – there's been a lot of steps in terms of the embassy being open for the first time. And so in 2014, we couldn't visit the embassy because there wasn't one officially. And in this last trip, there was the very first step place we went was getting a lecture by the embassy on what was happening and how things were developing. What's interesting about that is both times the Cubans themselves always want to know what's taking so long. Because they don't understand, you know, why we haven't done this already. And their hope was with President Obama coming in, you know, at the beginning of his term, they thought it would open up very quickly because that's when Castro started making overtures to the government that he would like to do this as part of the process. And it's sometimes you have to explain to him what a swing state is, you know. So we sort of try to make it simple on the concept of Florida, you know, as a swing state has been sort of the barb in the road.
You know, the barrier to trade with Cuba has been in place for more than 50 years now.
55 years.
Yeah. So, well, do you have a sense from what you've seen? Anybody have a sense of how long it's going to take for these barriers to come down and things to?
I think my impression, kind of how far things have come, it would be really hard to take a step backward. So I think that is a good thing. And you know, I can't speak to exactly when it would entirely open up, but I think that just given kind of where it's at now, the only way to go is just completely normalize relations, just because we're pretty much already on the cusp, and I think it would just be very difficult to go back. And there, you know, there isn't a lot of really support or really a reason, I guess, to go back. So
my expectation is it's probably still going to take a couple years, but we really need to do a lot now to get prepared for that to happen. So we need an act of Congress for it actually to take place. But, you know, in preparing to do that, because you can go there for business meetings, you can go there and experience Cuba, make connections, meet people, look at other businesses. I think there's really a lot that we can learn from them. We visited a social economic development place called Art Court that's actually started out as essentially a barbershop training other people to be barbers. And then they ended up working with kind of a couple streets in a neighborhood, got different retail establishments in all of the street fronts. They have no vacancies right now. They have the entrepreneurs work together, so they have the streets cleaned. They have they built a neighborhood park for the children in the area. They have within the park they actually have a barber, and then also a little vending area. And then they pay to keep the parking the playground clean, and then pay for someone to kind of watch over the kids as they're playing. So they're really bringing the entrepreneurs together as well to make the neighborhood better.
It's almost like a social-based 3CDC. I mean, they literally cleaned up a whole section of the town and closed it off to traffic and brought in independent businesses that all contribute. The same businesses also contribute to a senior like dining area so that seniors can get discounted meals, and also what they refer to as a senior rehab center so that elderly that needed help could go there for free and get services. And the businesses themselves were contributing all this on their own.
Tom, what do you think from a marketing aspect, what do you think would be the biggest challenges for a U.S. company to introduce products to Cuba once we get to that stage?
Again, it's navigating. Raul Castro has implemented what's called lineamientos, which is like 300 guidelines. And you have to understand the guidelines with regard to how to do the business. And the best way to do that is to be, you know, either down there studying it or partnering with a Cuban, you know, someone from Cuba, for example, Senius, you know, that already understands the process. And I think going back to what Scott has pointed out, and Heather, it's going to take a little bit only because they're going to have to do it slowly because Cuba, their infrastructure couldn't handle like a wide open door. So if all of a sudden tomorrow everybody who wanted to visit Cuba could visit Cuba, they couldn't handle it. They don't have the hotels. They don't have the infrastructure. Their systems, their electrical systems, water systems, everything needs to be upgraded.
Same with an influx of products.
Right, exactly.
Are there any U.S. products that have filtered through other countries that are available in Cuba?
Coca-Cola, I think, was one. There's a lot of.
Yeah. There was also Tucola, though.
Yeah. There was the Cuban, you know, Havana brand. Mm-hmm. But I think Yeah, in our hotel, they had Pepsi and Coke, and those were, I think, imported from Mexico. But that's another thing I think I was a little surprised at, is I expected there to maybe be a little bit more, but for the most part, it was pretty limited, especially in terms of hair care products and like toothpaste, that kind of stuff. There really wasn't a lot of any of that, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah, the only true American products you might see someplace would be sold by somebody who got it through their family. That, you know, so when you travel to Cuba, one of the things that you can't miss is at the airport are literally, you know, the carts that, you know, the red cabs push around to help you with your luggage. They're piled so high you can't see over them. And it takes hours to fly there and much shorter on the way back, simply because they have to get the weight. Relatives bring so much supplies and things to their families. You know, last time in 2014, I saw a water heater. Somebody was bringing a water heater to their relatives. So a lot of times people buy things in the United States, bring them down there, and then sell them through their, you know, out of their back door or something. So that's really the only way you're going to see a lot of American products.
Yeah, because you're talking about marketing to a population that's it's been so long under a socialist government-controlled system that the infrastructure is just not there for dealing with all this.
You're going to pretty much be using grassroots marketing type of efforts down there. We did see some things like, so for the cabs that were lined up, they had little laminated cards to help communicate with the people that maybe didn't speak Spanish. Was a way of their marketing.
Heather, did you see some other examples of business innovation in Cuba that would fit well into Cincinnati's startup culture?
Probably. One of the biggest things that I think that we could learn from them, I had worked on a project actually with a Xavier class as well in the fall that was targeting the fact that Cincinnati has the fourth highest childhood poverty rate in the nation. And Cuba actually has high poverty rate, but they're highly educated. So with the way they were working, I think we could learn from them and take those types of initiatives to places like Price Hill, because some of those underlying things like poverty and education, you really need jobs and economic development to really combat and change those things.
What are your hopes for the future with regards to relations with Cuba?
I'm excited for it. I can't wait to go back. I'm hoping to go back maybe in May of this year to an economic development conference. And I think that Cincinnati, particularly, we have a lot of consumer goods here. I think there's a lot of opportunity as far as construction, technology, infrastructure companies, marketing companies. There are many opportunities there, but we need to develop the relationships first.
Scott, what about you? What are your hopes for the future with regards to relations with Cuba?
I'd say mainly just that they eventually become completely open, just because, yeah, it's such an amazing country that, like Heather was saying, there's so many opportunities. I think if it were to be opened, I think a lot of people would be able to realize that and really enjoy what Cuba has to offer.
I couldn't look around and not see opportunity.
Yeah.
So, and Scott, in your case, since you're studying both international business and Spanish, are you hoping to someday work for a company that works with Spanish-speaking countries?
That would be great, yes.
So if there's anybody out there.
There's anybody out there who's listening.
Yeah.
Right. Who could use somebody who's majoring in international business and can speak Spanish at the same time. So, Tom, what kind of advice do you have for Cincinnati businesses if they eventually want to do business with Cuba?
Again, I would take advantage of the opportunities to go down there now and start to create relations, meet people. The Cuban people are, as Heather and Scott had pointed out, are very open. They're absolutely wonderful, inviting, warm people. And I think the idea of making those relationships and making friendships now is vital to be able, because it's not like you're just going to be able to come in and do a PowerPoint presentation and say we're here. You know, it's partly of built on it's a relationship business, and so I think making the relationships established now are vital to understanding how you might enter it later.
And if you can't find another way to get to Cuba, I think Xavier probably has another class on the books, at least in another year or so.
Right. Yeah, we run 7 international trips just in the College of Business a year.
So you definitely have more trips to Cuba planned.
Right.
Heather, what would be your advice for Cincinnati businesses who are thinking about doing business in Cuba?
I think you're going to have to go there first and see it, experience it, meet some of the people, make connections. You're going to go on tours, see different things. I feel like one of the things that we saw, I was surprised that the people that live there aren't necessarily participating in all of the things that we can participate in as tourists. So that part was a little bit disheartening.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what about you?
I would say, yeah, it's important to go there and have a relationship with somebody in Cuba or something like that. I don't think it'll be possible to just go there and expect to set up shop. And I think partly that's due to the Cuban government, because even if things were to be 100% open tomorrow, I think the Cuban government would still have some restrictions that they put in place. So I think, yeah, it's important to kind of know the market and kind of establish a relationship with a Cuban business or, a Cuban person in order to be able to set up business.
And my only flip side of that is my only fear is that the Cuban people have this culture. It's an amazing culture of taking care of each other. I mean, things that they've gone through for the last 55 years, they're very much supportive of each other. And I'm hoping once it opens to more of American cultures that we don't screw it up.
Tom, Scott, and Heather, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Xavier University Williams College of Business Chair and Professor of Marketing, Dr. Thomas Hayes. Xavier MBA student and tax manager with Barnes Dennig, Heather Hotlos, and Scott Quintemont, who's a junior studying international business at Xavier.